Swedish British journalist, filmmaker, political writer, and author of 5 books, Pelle Neroth Taylor, on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've got Jeff Dornick as our first guest in this second hour. He's a great fan. He's a chief executive of the Pickaxe and co-founder of the Freedom First Network. And he's a great fan of RFK, or Robert Kennedy. He's the nephew of John F. K., who famously was assassinated in 1963. And it's increasingly become apparent that, to scholars, that he was very interested in pursuing détente with the Russians, and that might have been the prime reason for his assassination. RFK is also very much in favor of peace in Ukraine, and has a lot of, is bang on the money on a lot of issues, like, for instance, vaccines and the dangers of a very powerful pharma industry and other things. And Jeff is going to talk all about RFK's chances in the presidential election. He's standing alongside Biden and Trump, and it could pull in votes from either side. So is he going to be the wild card and joker in this election? Jeff also thinks that Trump has made some misjudgments in his demonization of RFK, which doesn't look good. I've got Larry Schweikart as a second guest, a very well-known historian in the United States. And he's going to talk to us about Trump's other case, the one in Washington, the one being heard by the Supreme Court, and whether the clouds are gathering or if they are lightening up, because there's an argument that he'll be declared immune from prosecution in an election-related case that was brought by special counsel Jack Smith. I personally doubt that, but we can talk about it. But before we go into analysis with Basil, I just want to say that, give a heads up to, there was a very interesting meeting in Hungary at the weekend, and under Orban's aegis, Orban is almost as much hated by people like Anne Applebaum, whom I spoke about at the last monologue, as she's a liberal Atlanticist, you know, American supremacism kind of person. And Orban, of course, stands up for the nation state, and he's fighting both the EU and the American embassy in Budapest, which has made clear its displeasure with this man who resists immigration and the transgender craze. Now, Eva Vladingerbroek is a young Dutch journalist. She was there recently and gave a beautiful speech that pointed out that the great replacement theory is not actually a conspiracy theory. Now, conspiracy theory is incredibly misused title, and I think that it only ought to refer to things that you can't disprove. It's an ideological statement when you believe a conspiracy theory, and another person could come up with this counter arguments, you won't move away from your position, and you're not interested in evidence. That's a conspiracy theorist. But where you make a claim and then you back it up with facts, and you have a hypothesis, and where the facts seem to point in your direction, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's just a theory, and it might be proved true or wrong. And she says, well, the great replacement is not a conspiracy theory, because it's actually happening. The Hague is 58% immigrant, Rotterdam 60% immigrant, Brussels 70% migrant, Malmo 50% migrant, and so on. So Europe is losing its identity in its very nature, and it's becoming another place. The people who are coming might not be worse people, and very often they're persecuted. I mean, just look at the genocide in Gaza. But it's changing. We need to discuss that, because while we have the 20 rights conferred to us by the United Nations, it does not include the right to settle wherever you want in the world. So you can be entirely against massacring Palestinians, you could be entirely in favor of free speech, social rights, and so on, but that does not mean that you have a right to go and move from America to Sweden, or Sweden to America, or Israel to Nigeria, or whatever. That's not a human right, and that was a given thing until the 1990s, and then Tony Blair came along, and all the globalists, if you like, and then we've got where we are. Anyway, I advise you to, if you're interested in that full speech, to go to the Gateway Pundit and read it all, because she is making a very powerful case for voting for parties, like Orban's if you're Hungarian, but the populist parties in the European elections coming up in June, because our leaders are just not listening to us on this issue, and they're just pursuing their own quixotic goals. Anyway, we've got Basil Valentine now for more news and analysis just after a very quick break. This is the Pelinyaroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Back after the break.
It's the stuff.
What citizen wouldn't want to make American great again?
People are talking about.
Vilifying MAGA is just not going to work.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelinyaroth Taylor Show. We've got Basil Valentine, our political editor. Yes.
Well, I just want to add a few comments to what you were saying about the grace replacement theory and the waves of mass migration that we're now seeing, totally unprecedented. A lot of it, of course, is from countries that were destabilized or destroyed by the 9/11 wars, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and East Africa. So to some extent, the conspiracy theory element of the Great Replacement story comes from whether or not those wars were started partly to cause those migrants to flee Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and the Horn of Africa. That, you know, the objectives of those wars, which were never really discovered, all sorts of possible esoteric reasons. Oil, of course, was one cited for Iraq, but we always had access to enough Iraqi oil without destroying the place. Likewise, Afghanistan obviously had nothing whatsoever to do with 9/11. And it is indeed a good chunk of people from those countries that are now flooding into Western Europe. So the question people ask is, were those wars started in order to break up those countries and cause these migrant flows?
Break up the target countries? That's an even further possibility. I mean, I heard from a top Swedish diplomat who said that, destroy the host countries and the original countries, because their elites are fleeing. And so the doctors and dentists, they're sitting in Sweden rather than sitting in Baghdad and reconstructing their countries. So, migrants are a tool of war. Nothing wrong with the migrants, but they are used. They're like invading armies. Invading armies you can't fire back at, basically. But not to blame them, necessarily.
Likewise, of course, the destruction of Syria. I mean, Syria served effectively as a plug on the top of Africa. And Gaddafi stopped the human trafficking, you know.
That's right.
Forget it. Just this morning, I've seen a report of 50 African migrants who set off from Senegal have drowned when their boat capsized en route to the Canary Islands, 50 dead. You know, doesn't even register a ripple or in the international media. But the migratory pressure from sub-Sahara is particularly strong because of the rapidly expanding population there. And the Sahara Desert itself had been a physical barrier, total physical barrier, impossible to cross. But, you know, now that's not quite so much the case. You can pick your way across.
I think they've built a tarmac road across it now. Yeah.
Right.
No, I mean, I think one of the total weaknesses of the right, although it's beginning to change now, is that they blame everything on Islam or Muslims or migrants per se. And they're totally blind to the geopolitics, the larger story, the West is, to somehow, it's a kind of, what's the word, a blowback, and we deserve it. But some of the more aware ones are taking foreign policy positions that you traditionally associated with the left, which is anti-imperialist, because they realize it really is true that our policies are leading to these things. Although, of course, it's not small countries like Sweden and Holland and Hungary are the instigators. It's the great powers on the other side of the ocean, if you like, and it's wrecking small European countries. It's a good point. Yeah.
So now to the main story I was going to cover, which is that we have this ceasefire deal on the table, apparently, and Hamas negotiators have left Cairo and will be returning with a letter, with a written response. But meanwhile, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that Israel will enter the city of Rafah in southern Gaza to eliminate Hamas with or without a ceasefire and hostage release deal, adding that the notion of ending the war, I don't like to call it a war, the slaughter, before Israel has reached its objectives is not an option. And this, of course, is causing tremendous anxiety for the 1.5 million people displaced across crowded Rafah City. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud was reporting from Rafah, says people are losing hope for a potential ceasefire. What makes it worse right now is people feel like they are in limbo. They don't know whether there is a deal. And in case there is a deal, Netanyahu promised he would invade Rafah, which makes the whole point of going to a deal pointless. There is a great deal of anguish, worry, concern, and frustration as things are not clear. People say it's similar to past narratives of people, of moving people and herding them from one place to another for the purpose of evacuating them to safe zones that eventually happen not to be safe at all. And I think the reasons why the Israelis want the ceasefire, they're going to go ahead and attack anyway, but obviously the optics are much worse, both for them and for the United States and United Kingdom, if they attack a city of 1.5 million people, the vast majority of them refugees, including hundreds of thousands of women and children. That doesn't look good. That's why Andrew Mitchell, the Deputy Foreign Secretary, said that the UK government is, so he claims, doing everything it can to prevent such an assault, and why David Cameron and Tony Blinken are so keen for Hamas to accept the deal. The reason is this: it suits the Israelis. They get all the women and children out of Rafah and into tents, thereby accomplishing the one goal of partial ethnic cleansing. They can then go for hell for leather for the remaining male population and anybody unfortunate enough to be left behind, and come out claiming to be the great humanitarians or something. I mean, it really is through the looking glass stuff, Kelly.
So do you think that, because those of us who are looking at the ceasefire as a possible bright spot are sort of hoping, well, once you put down your weapons, if you lay down your weapons, that's it. It'll be harder to start up again. But you think that maybe pushing through the ceasefire will just, in a way, give Israel cover for an unspeakably cruel action. I mean, and so that they shouldn't be allowed this ceasefire.
It's a very good question. This ceasefire may be a smokescreen. You see, if Hamas were to agree to a 40-day ceasefire, let's say 500,000 citizens are ethnically cleansed during that period, basically herded around like cattle. There's nowhere to go, into tents, which we've already seen starting to be erected. Then, and of course, Israel would get the hostages out, most or all of their hostages in that period, in exchange for this pause. Then they go hell for leather in 40 days' time and say, well, look, we said we were going to, the ceasefire was only temporary. We've got to eliminate Hamas. Now, the key question is, what does that look like, eliminating Hamas? Mm. Does it mean killing every fighting-aged male in Rafah? Because that seems to have been the policy quite openly stated to date.
Yeah. And of course, once they got the ceasefire, the Israelis can then claim to say that, well, they're following the rules and that it's a better look in world opinion, or at least in American opinion.
That's right. And of course, it might cause the protests on the college campuses to break up, which are severe irritants to the Israelis and of course their colleagues on Capitol Hill. They're absolutely doing their nut about that, because it's this tremendous outpouring of human empathy, simple as that.
And 40 days, of course, coincides neatly with the end of term in American universities, and everybody would go on their summer holidays working in soda fountains or whatever. There won't be any more protests.
The end of that, basically.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So it's all rather cynical. As we speak, the campuses are more numerous and more populated than ever before. So the idea that this might be one or two isolated pockets and all died down very quickly, you can forget that, particularly at Columbia. And, no real official response from the Biden administration except a few words of condemnation. But of course, governors like Greg Abbott and Ron DeSantis who are dyed-in-the-wool hardcore Zionists, I would call them. I mean, DeSantis actually held a meeting of the Floridian cabinet in Israel. He's that committed. They've been making all sorts of deeply unconstitutional threats towards their own students.
Okay, Basil, unless you've got something else, we've got to head off to our third guest of today, talking about RFK, and he's very pro-Israeli, unfortunately, I think, but he's got a lot of other good things about him. So thanks a lot, Basil. We'll talk to two more tomorrow, and
very quickly,
have a good afternoon.
Very quickly, Pelle, I'm covering for Patrick Henningsen again tonight, where I will be joined by Roger Stone and Dr. Frank Romano. Frank is in Istanbul with the peace convoy, hoping to set sail very soon, possibly under an Irish flag. More at 9 UK time tonight.
Well, do watch Roger Stone, actually, because I was reading his book last night, as it happens, about Nixon. He's an incredible guy. Well done for bagging him. Okay. This is the Pelle Neroff-Taylor Show on TNT, and we'll be back with our third guest after the break.
TNT's Joseph Arthur.
I wonder if you can simplify sort of the different components of the war that we're in, how it's working, what the motivation is.
The bottom line is nitrogenous fertilizers are one of the main engines, and those are being interrupted. And that's why I went to BASF twice before Nord Stream was cut, because I suspected they were going to cut Nord Stream. So I was there with Misako Gnaha at BASF, and I asked somebody inside the plant, it's a 10 square kilometer plant, right? And so I asked him, what happens if Nord Stream is interrupted? This was before it was interrupted. He said, we are dead. Well, now it's gone. It's been destroyed, right? And I predicted that publicly.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk, TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
A hoax about carbon dioxide in the climate has caused a global energy and economic disaster. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Right. Welcome back to the Pelle Neroff-Taylor Show. We've got Jeff Dornick with us, who's the CEO of Pickaxe and co-founder of the Freedom First Network, which produces dozens of shows at Aaron Rumble and Apple podcasts. And he's a great supporter of RFK Jr. Now, I've talked a lot about JFK on this show and his various peace moves towards the end of his period in office before he was assassinated, and even speculate about whether this was the reason why he was killed. Also, I think it was his support for civil rights and other things. But RFK Jr. got the magic Kennedy name, and he is the son of Robert Kennedy, who was assassinated in 1968, JFK's brother. So, Jeff, welcome to the show. We're going to talk about RFK because, of course, he's running for president and he could make a difference. Do you think he could make a difference?
Yeah, I do.
No, but yeah,
no, yeah. It's interesting. So I've been a Trump supporter since going all the way back to 2012, when I wish Trump would have run instead of Mitt Romney back then, and that was my one big disappointment. In 2016, I was a Rand Paul guy until Trump came down the escalator and gave that initial speech, and I'm like, yeah, that his platform is the platform that we need. For me, looking ahead to this 2024 election, you know, there's a couple specific things that I think that we have to deal with, you know, that if we do not fix, we basically don't have a country here in the United States of America. And I think it's the corporate capture of the regulating agencies, things like the FDA, CDC, USDA, EPA. You know, all of those that are completely controlled by these big corporations, and then also the intelligence agencies, aka the deep state. Those two things, if we don't fix those two things, in my opinion, we can't fix anything else, because the big corporations and the intelligence agencies are running the show. And that's where I think Trump played his role back in 2016, where he was the bull in the China shop, came in, exposed a lot of the corruption. But, you know, for all of RFK's faults and disagreements that I have with him, I'm getting the feeling as we're moving along that he actually knows where the bodies are buried, what's going on, how to fix the problem here. And that's why I've become very, very supportive of RFK Jr.
I think you could be right. I mean, I've heard him. I also enjoyed, as I said, the sort of Sex Pistol style of Trump. You know, there's a famous interview of this first punk band in 1978 where they said the F word on the BBC 10 times or something, and everybody was terribly shocked. And it, you know, they were just really, they changed the world of music, and Trump was kind of changing things. We hoped he was going to rock the world, the staid and corrupt world of Washington. But of course, he's been tied up in lots of he hired a lot of neocons, and he's tied up in his various cases now, judicial cases, lawfare from the Democrats. And RFK, when I've heard him interviewed, he's had some voice problems, some problems, health problems there, but he's incredibly articulate and clever. So tell us more about what his policies are and how he could be the real Trump, the man that you hoped for with Trump, but didn't materialize. Where is RFK going to fill those gaps?
Yeah, well, I think RFK begins to fill the gaps in actually providing the solutions to the problems. I think that Trump did a phenomenal job at exposing the corruption. I think if it was not for Trump, I think the masses would not understand just how corrupt the mainstream media is, the collusion between the mainstream media and the intelligence agencies and the Uniparty. I think that the vast majority of Americans would still be in the dark when it comes to a lot of those issues. So I don't want to take anything away from Trump, and I'm also not anti-Trump as well, you know, because you know, if it was just between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, I would be 100%. Donald Trump's definitely the better option of the two. And I would go to sleep at night knowing that, okay, our country's headed in the right direction. For me, however, if we're looking at the trajectory of where we're going, I think that we do need to deal with a handful of things. Like I said, dealing with the intelligence agencies, we need to completely dismantle them and then restart up from the ground up, because they're completely corrupt. They're running the show. They are basically blackmailing and bribing our own politicians to where our politicians are doing the bidding of the intelligence agencies, as opposed to the other way around. We've also got, and this is one of the things that RFK keeps talking about as well, is the chronic illness that we have in this country right now. And a lot of it is because of that corporate capture that is going on with the regulating agencies, to where we've got vaccines that are causing all sorts of harm. We've got things like pesticides and chemicals and Roundup and all of these different kinds of things. You know, I've been very intentional about the food that goes in my body, the water that goes in my body. I look out my office window every single day. I see the chemtrails going across the sky, where it's documented they're dropping silver iodide into the sky, which is harmful to all biological life. There's things that are going on that are causing these long-term chronic illnesses, and I do not believe that Trump has a grasp of that or understands that. And also, he was hoodwinked during COVID by people like Fauci, who he gave an award to, and the CDC and the FDA and all of that. So I think when it comes to those things, I think RFK is far superior. I think RFK is equivalent when it comes to foreign policy. I think he's equivalent when it comes to illegal immigration and border security. There's definitely a lot of things where I think there's a lot of overlap between RFK and Donald Trump. But I think that those two things, the regulating industries, agencies, and the intelligence agencies, I think the RFK is far superior. And those are the two things that we have to fix if we want to have a country.
Yeah, I agree. I think America needs a new church committee. I mean, obviously, RFK's uncle wanted to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces after Bay of Pigs. And anyway, he signed his death warrant already then. And then the Cubans and the CIA plotted to kill him. And it was actually after Nixon that you brought him together, this church committee, which is really going to have a look at the CIA. It didn't do nearly enough. And I think Britain, for that matter, needs to have a reckoning with its own deep state. But there was speculation that JFK... that Trump would take on RFK as his running mate. But I'll just read quickly here from Donald Trump's recent post on Truth Social, I think, which you requoted. "I lived with RFK Jr. in New York and watched him convince Governor Cuomo to make environmental moves that were outright nasty. Upstate New York was not allowed to drill or frack as Ohio and others. Because of this, prices have skyrocketed all over that part of the country. The energy costs are highest in the U.S., with the exception of California. I'd even take Biden over Junior," meaning RFK, "because our country would last a year or two longer prior to collapse. But that would be dead either way. His views on vaccines are fake, as is everything else about his candidacy. So that's a kind of declaration of war against RFK and the supporters of RFK, who are probably, many of them are Trump supporters as well. So that's a high risk strategy, but we'll talk about that after a very quick news break. Back after the break, talking about RFK. This is the Pelinero with Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
Great news.
The news.
We have news.
Great news.
Great news. Great news.
Great news, my friends.
Yeah. Listen.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen stated that the EU has not dismissed the possibility of banning the Chinese-owned video platform TikTok, citing security concerns. A dam breach in Kenya, triggered by intense rains and flooding, has resulted in at least 42 deaths, according to Nakuru County Governor Susan Kihika. The incident occurred near the town of Maimahu, causing extensive damage to homes and road blockages.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelinero with Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. We've got Jeff Dornick, who's the CEO of Pickaxe and co-founder of the Freedom First Network, with us. And we're talking about RFK, who's running for president. What do you think of that Trump all-out attack on RFK? Why did he do it, and was it wise? And what does it say about Trump?
I think it says that he's either being dishonest, which is not good, or he's trusting the wrong people, which is also not good. So either way, it's not a good scenario. And I will say this: I was. I posted a couple tweets about this, but I was actively involved in trying to put together an RFK Trump ticket. So much so that I was actually working on connecting the two campaigns together, and so I pieced that all together. I've talked about this, and I could go into more detail about that. But it was interesting, because what ended up happening is I was reached out to by friend who was like, look, I just spoke with RFK and his team, and they said that if Donald Trump offered him the VP spot, that he would take it. So I connected them with a key insider over in Team Trump. Within a matter of a week, Donald Trump started attacking RFK, you know, beyond into oblivion, and it was crazy, because I'm like, what is going on? Because, you know, there's people like Steve Bannon, who is one of Trump's top advisors, who wants a Trump RFK ticket. I know that for a fact. And so the fact that Trump is saying that RFK is more to the left and worse than Joe Biden is beyond insane. And both sides have kind of denied things. RFK started saying that, yeah, the Trump team came over and initiated things, which I know for a fact is true. But I think that what's happening right now is Donald Trump, instead of putting aside his ego and saying, look, for the betterment of the country, we're going to join forces and we're going to create a unity ticket between RFK and myself. What he's doing is he's going on the attack and treating RFK as if it's the same as going after Ted Cruz back in 2016. This is very different, because the thing that Donald Trump had back in 2016 is he not only had the America First crowd, he not only had the Republican support, but he had independents and he had sane Democrats that came over and voted for him. They crossed party lines and voted for him because he was talking their language. What's happening right now is instead he's alienating anybody that's not a part of his base. And I find that very dangerous. And this is why I find this misstep so very dangerous to the future of America right now, is because what he's doing is he's basically trying to win the election by subtraction. I'm sorry, but you win by addition. And I think that what's going to end up happening is that RFK is going to continue to gain more and more support as time goes on. I don't know whether he's going to be able to get enough support in order to ultimately win. But at the very least, I could see a scenario where there's a contested convention, a contested election at the very end, where who knows who's going to be put in a place. It might even be somebody who's not one of these three candidates. But but what should happen, and I've talked to Mel Kay about this on our show that we have every other week, on the Unfiltered Truth, is Donald Trump and RFK need to put aside their egos, come together as a unity ticket for the betterment of this country. For the very fact that you would ensure a blowout victory come November of 2024. But if they don't come together, it's going to be a very difficult path, in my opinion, for Trump to win.
Yeah, it seems like a no-brainer, because obviously if Trump is going to attract some kind of leftists or liberals who put off by Trump and they respect RFK's articulacy in some of his positions, and they're not going to like the way that their hero is being insulted by Trump. I mean, it sounds, and of course, as you said, I don't know if he's on 10 or 15% of the voter support RFK. That's a significant number. And if you could bring them over to Trump's side, then it'd be a slam dunk for a Republican victory. And as you said, I mean, you've really given me a scoop there. It's something I didn't know, because I always assumed that RFK was the one who said no. It was floated by some people. And that, RFK said, I don't want to associate with Trump and his far rightists or whatever. But if he said yes, and it's Trump who said no, that's extraordinary. I mean, it really is. And as you said, it's going to be a three-way then come November, with a very complicated electoral mathematic, with all three candidates with their own varying numbers of seats. So is Trump, I mean, there's some people saying that Trump's gone a bit doolally, as we say in English. I mean, a bit demented, because it really is unnecessary what he did there. I mean, what do you think is going on there? Is it Trump's advisors, or is it Trump? Is it an egotistical thing, or what is it?
I think there's a lot of people talking in Trump's ear, and this has been one of my criticisms, and this has been one of my questions ever since Trump got out of office. Is so what's going to change between term one and term two? Because in Trump's first term, he surrounded himself by the swamp. He talked about draining the swamp, but he surrounded himself with the swamp. Brought in people like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and all these guys and all these horrific advisors. Well, now we're here, you know, this time around, maybe he's not quite bringing the swamp in, but he's got these horrific grifters that are surrounding him in his inner circle. And I think what's happening is they're saying, no, you got to go hardcore America first, which I agree from a platform standpoint. But if you want to appeal to people outside of the MAGA movement, which is a minority of the Republican Party, you're going to have to figure out how to get outside of that bubble. And all the VP people that they're floating, you know, I'm like, you're just going to get your base to vote for you harder. How does that actually help you to win? You need to bring in somebody that will help you to get the moderate Republicans, to get the sane Democrats, to get the independents. And I think what's happening is you know, they're pushing this thing of loyalty. You know, people like Laura Loomer and Brendan Dilley and a lot of Trump surrogates are talking about loyalty all the time. Well, I'm sorry, but loyalty doesn't win you elections, unfortunately. And this is the thing that you've got to realize. There's a strategy in play, and I'm telling you, I'm surrounded by Democrats and I'm surrounded by independents out here in communist California who are sick and tired of the Democrats, but they cannot bring themselves to vote for Donald Trump, because all he's doing is attacking people. Attacking. What about laying out your agenda like you did back in 2015 and 2016 that united the country, that brought Democrats to even vote for you? That's how you win. And unfortunately, Trump's not doing it. You know who is doing that? RFK. Every single tweet that he's posting is an articulate layout of his policies and his positions. Every single interview is a layout of the unifying principles that he's pushing for his agenda. You may agree with him, you may disagree with him, but at least he's forcing the conversations that I think we need to have. That's what Donald Trump did back in 2016 that he's lost. I want Donald Trump back from 2016, not this 2024 version.
Jeff, we'll have to talk about RFK next time in more detail, but in the minute we've got left, could you just drop a couple of names of VP candidates that Trump is considering and is serious about, even though they won't be as good as RFK? So we've got about 45 seconds left.
Yeah, so the one of the names that keeps popping up is J.D. Vance, which you know, I think from a principled standpoint, he'd be great. I think Byron Donalds is another one. From a principled standpoint, he'd be great, but I don't see them bringing in votes to help him win. Tulsi Gabbard, I would argue, is probably the only one that could actually bring over some of the sane independents and Democrats and things like that. I'm still pushing for Trump to do an about face and do a unity ticket with RFK and Trump. I think that's the ticket to victory.
Jeff, I agree with you. It sounds very plausible. And is there a date when we can expect him to make that announcement?
Yeah, he's probably going to do it. I would guess within the next month or so from what I'm hearing. Right. Initially, I'd heard it was going to be in April. Obviously, we're at the end of April. Probably going to be May, I'm guessing.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much, Jeff Dornick, CEO of Pickaxe and co-founder of the Freedom First Network. Excellent up-to-date summary of what's going on in the vice presidential campaign or election there and the RFK-Trump conflict possible. Thank you very much. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We'll be back with our final guest on this Tuesday afternoon. Thanks, Jeff. Great stuff.
Anticipate potential delays for the morning commute. In other news, a recent government report on prescription drug pricing points to corporate
Freedom of the press is about your right to know.
What are you talking about, man? Look at his stats. Mark sheer
athleticism. It's about your right to be informed. Your right to access all types of information keeps us free as a nation.
No.
Today, there are real threats to press freedom. And your right to know about the world around us.
Look.
Some threats are obvious, some are easy to miss, but they all put our way of life at risk. We must defend against all of these threats, no matter what kind of news is important to you.
Justified putting American troops in harm's way?
That's a great question.
We must protect our right to know before it's too late. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
Are you ready to help your family get prepared for the unexpected?
Here we go!
Ladybug and Cat Noir know how important it is to be ready. Because you never know when Hawk Moth is going to strike or a disaster will hit. And you don't need miraculous powers. Just put those planning skills you already have to good use. Make a plan that will help you and your family be ready when emergencies happen. Ready Kids can help. Get started at ready.gov/kids.
Coming to you live from Sweden, you're with Pelle Neroth Taylor on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. We've got the brilliant Larry Schweikart with us today, a returning guest and a friend. He's written many books about American history and is very, very well-known best-selling writer. A native Arizonian, he went to Arizona State University and received a BA in political science. He went on the road with different rock bands, opening for such acts as Steppenwolf and the James Gang, and then wanted to become a history professor and received an MA from ASU in history and a PhD from History of California, Santa Barbara. Since 1984-85, he's taught at the University of Dayton. His best-selling books include Seven Events That Made America America, 48 Liberal Lies About American History, and the number one New York Times bestseller, Mike Allen, A Patriot's History of the United States. We're going to talk about a couple of news events that are sort of floating about, drawn from his website. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Thank you, Pelle. Good to be here.
We talk about Trump nearly every day, and we try to keep a European audience informed about this utter profusion and confusion of different cases. And we covered the case in New York and why there might be things looking up for Trump a little bit there. But you recently tweeted or looked at what's going on in Washington. Could you tell us perhaps a little bit about that in very, very general terms? Because there have been some developments on that case.
Sure. Well, back in December, several of the liberal pundits were chagrined to find that the Supreme Court had accepted looking at the Trump immunity appeal. And back in December, many of them said, that's it. These trials are going to be delayed until after the election. They were smart enough to see that that was coming. So the Supreme Court, of course, agreed to hear the immunity defense. And basically, a president has immunity from any official acts he takes while in office. That doesn't include private acts. As someone once said, if you murder your wife with a candlestick or something, you can't expect immunity from that. But the issues are that most of the things he's accused of doing, talking to congressmen, asking the DOJ to look into fraud, these are all official acts that any president would take. So the Supreme Court then heard the oral arguments last week, and they're not expected to rule until possibly June, meaning that even if they rule against Trump, and nobody thinks they will, but even if they rule against Trump, no trial is going to start until after the election, when either Trump can pardon himself or Biden might be tempted to pardon him and Hunter consecutively.
Yeah. Because obviously I looked at some of the coverage, and several of the Supreme Court justices saying, well, we're ruling for the ages here. So if we were to rule against Trump, we have immunity for congressmen and for Supreme Court judges. Why don't we have immunity for presidents? I mean, it'll be a cascade of impeachments or attacks or criminal cases against every successive president to Trump. I mean, Obama could be done in for his drone attacks in the Middle East and so on, and it'll be endless lawfare. But what were Trump's opponents hoping to do him in for? I mean, what was their ambition on the immunity by saying he didn't have immunity?
Well, the original goal, and they really messed this up. They put everything they had in this election on lawfare, and they seriously believed that they were going to have Trump convicted and in jail before the Republican nominating convention, let alone before the election. Mm. And when the Supreme Court took that immunity case, that screwed all of that up. And now it leaves only the New York case by Alvin Bragg, or as I call him, Boston Bragg, Alvin Boston Bragg, there to try to get Trump on this ridiculous misdemeanor charge that they have concocted into some sort of federal charge. So my court guru, an anonymous source I call Zen Master, says that he fully expects the Supreme Court will remand the immunity case back to the lower court and say, you tell us what you think is an official act versus a private act in all of these charges, and then we will take a look at it again if we think that's necessary. So by doing that, they're ruling in favor of Trump. My guy Zen Master thinks it'll be 5-4, but could easily be 6-3, and he even thinks possibly one of the liberal judges will go along. Because as you say, the alternative here is for any attorney general anywhere to go after George W. Bush for war crimes, to go after Barack Obama for drone bombing an American U.S. citizen outside of due process of law. I mean, it opens such a can of worms, you can't imagine that they would say anything other than a president has immunity in official acts.
Right. And just were you just mentioning that New York case, because I talked about the New York case earlier with someone. Was that the one involving his lawyer, Michael Cohen, or is it yet another one?
Well, Cohen is involved as a witness in this.
Yeah,
for
right.
Supposedly paying off Stormy Daniels.
Yeah.
And the whole question is whether or not this was part of a campaign or whether it was done before this or whatnot. Now, Daniels herself has said on multiple occasions there was no payoff. So they're having real trouble. I do expect he will get convicted. I don't care how flimsy the evidence is or how weak the case is. They're going to convict him in New York. No Republican, certainly no conservative, can get a fair trial in Washington, D.C. or New York City or Chicago. But then the appeals start, and then that's going to go till after the election as well.
Right. So we won't see Trump in jail more. It's very unlikely until the election. And then he'll be off free anyway if he gets elected president.
Correct.
Yeah. And so it's basically it's those two things. It's the Washington case and the Stormy Daniels case. And the Stormy Daniels case seems to be neutralized by a sort of a victory for Trump in the Supreme Court. And then he will be convicted in New York because the trial, the jurors there are unfairly and extremely Democratic. But it will go to appeal and he will be out of jail until the election at least. Okay. Well, that's a short version because, you know, you look at the scrolling news on, let's say, the BBC and you have to read for hours and hours to make head and tails of it. We're just going to move to another subject, which is interesting, which you put on your homepage, and because you give an incredibly useful summary of all the hot topics of the day and they're worth discussing, a really go-to website. The plummeting birth rate, according to the sobering data published by the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, the birth rate in the United States has plummeted to a new low. According to figures, fewer than 3.6 million babies were born in the U.S. last year, the lowest number for almost 45 years, and the lowest fertility rate since records began. That's rather worrying, isn't it, Larry? Did you think?
Oh, yeah, the whole birth dearth across the world, except for Islamic countries. Those are the only countries showing a rising birth rate. But even China now has huge problems with a falling birth rate. Japan has big problems. When you get into this kind of doom loop, you don't have enough younger employees to come into the system to be working to pay into social services. And as we have in America, Social Security, things like that. Plus, societies start to lose their edge because, let's face it, it is the young and the aggressive who come up with most of the inventions, not all, but most of them. And so that tends to slow down economies as well. So it's a very concerning thing. However, there is this interesting stat that by 2030, the United States will have a younger average age than China, which is pretty shocking.
Wow. What do you think the reasons are for this? I'll give you a couple of my theories, but I thought I'd hear yours first, because we've seen this growth of feminism, growth of decline of religion, you know, growth of the realize yourself mentality, higher mortgages. It's very difficult for younger people to get on the housing ladder, at least in Europe, and get jobs even, you know, AI is taking over. What are your thoughts?
Well, especially here in America, we've had a war on men going on for about 20 years. You see this in college statistics, where now over 52% of colleges are female students. Men are dropping out of colleges. They're going into more what we would call blue collar type jobs. But there are these biases against men throughout the society. If you don't permit men to go out and get a job and be earners and be providers, they have no incentive really to get married. And so the marriage rates have fallen, and thus the kid rate has fallen.
Yeah, right. I talked to a lot of guests on this show, and one of the most staggering statistics was that there are more blacks in med school than whites. Now, if you consider that whites are six times as numerous in the United States as blacks, that means an underrepresentation of white that's quite extraordinary. And then if you look at the number of male whites, you know, I mean, most Americans are still white and it's still a male. There are very few of them at med school, and maybe that's echoed throughout the professions. And of course, women want to marry up. I mean, biology doesn't change. They want a protector, I think, despite what feminism tells them. And so they can't find someone that is better than they are. They themselves have these good educations, and they're going to have to marry down, or they don't marry at all. So I think we need an honest discussion about these things. And unfortunately, the mainstream media, written by young women, they're completely stuck in certain ideological positions, which mean it's very difficult to get anything published that really questions this, especially in Europe. I think in America, you have a much more open debate about these things, as most things, I think.
Well, I think that the debate, how open it is still up in the air. We've seen some studies that show, for example, that most of the new academic material, the studies, whether it's in hard sciences or social sciences, they're focusing smaller and smaller and smaller in what they're looking at, because they want to avoid risk, because there's a culture right now of eschewing or avoiding risk in all things. Yeah. Because you might get outed, you might get canceled. And as a result, no one wants to go out on a limb and say, you know, I have a new theory for, you know, an anti-gravity device or whatever it is. And so the number, you can't think of a new major breakthrough since the internet. I mean, this is staggering. When we look in the early 1800s, for example, new inventions were coming one after another after another. So it is cycling through all of society. And of course, quotas don't help. Racial quotas don't help, especially when you look at the fact that many of the schools are abandoning test scores as a way of admitting people, because they seem to have a preference for whites. No matter how you kind of arrange the test score, whites do better on academic tests as a whole than blacks do. So this is a big problem. We're graduating a generation of, shall we say, possibly incompetent doctors.
And of course, you get a lot of clever people who don't get into the system at all. And, you know, no one wants to marry them, and they're not passing on their genes or whatever. Exactly. So it's a very bad circle. Anyway, we've got a couple of minutes left. Just thought about electric vehicles. There's an interesting, we in Europe, we don't follow the very latest. So we have this Elon Musk. I'm very positive to his takeover of Twitter. He's really opened up the debate there. And we sort of vaguely look at his space launches and think all is going well there. But Tesla's share prices are cratering, apparently. And the EV, the prospects for EV are not that great. The self-driving vehicles are going to come later than we think. And we've got this perennial problem of getting batteries. Where are we going to mine have you any thoughts about where EVs are going?
Yeah, my thought has been for some time that we're already peaking. I thought we might peak around 2030. But right now, the only people who can afford Teslas are the, you know, fairly rich people. It's starting to come out that the batteries are very dangerous in and of themselves, that they can explode, they start fires, that they're incredibly expensive, anywhere from $20,000 to $28,000 for the single battery, that we aren't anywhere remotely close to having the grid capacity to support a fleet of electric vehicles. And I have always thought that by the time they get into a position to actually make EVs truly popularized vehicles, we're going to be off onto some other type of power source, whether it's hydrogen or something else. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's why we need one of these breakthroughs, but it ain't going to be EVs.
Mm. I heard something that hydrogen vehicles might be the thing, but it also, it goes back to this idea that we're not innovating as much as we used to. I saw that the peak innovation was sort of 100 years ago, and we've right. also seen slowly declining IQs, where that's got to do with the lead in the water or something. So, Larry, are you working on any books or any projects coming up that sort of capture the moment, capture this period in history?
Well, I just released my Patriot's History of Globalism, Its Rise and Decline. So people can look for that. They can get a package deal at our website. The Wild World of History. You mentioned my news feed. If you go to the Wild World of Politics Monday through Friday, I have today's news down in the left corner. You click on that, and I'll give you the top 20 to 40 stories with a little bit of snark and wise comments. I am in the process of looking at America in the 21st century, and I have a contract for that book to come out next year sometime after the election.
That Patriot, well, we got 3 minutes left. That Patriot's History of Globalism, tell us some of the main lines of thought in that book.
Sure. Well, I go back 200 years to the Congress of Vienna and the eviction of Napoleon, and how beginning then global elites, and globalism is defined as a group of elites seeking to control large masses of people without regard to nationality or boundaries. And so they started back then. They continued through the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations, failed miserably there. They tried again with scientists after World War II to impose a kind of scientific international body controlling atomic energy. As soon as the Russians started acting up under Joe Stalin, American public opinion ditched that very quickly. Probably the longest running globalist program has been Bretton Woods, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which is just now starting to unravel due to the costs of the U.S. military having to protect trade routes. And the U.S. public is saying, enough, we're just done with that. And then the last chapters, I go into medical globalism and climate change globalism. And in the conclusion, I offer a lot of hope that I think they're on their heels now. And all we need is one good push and they'll go over.
Well, I mean, do you think I was just, I'm based in Europe, so I'm interested in where we're going in Europe. And there's a lot of talk of reshoring everything. You know, we're seeing the end of using energy from Russia and consumer goods from China, and somehow bringing back our manufacturing and basically having a sort of Hamiltonian economies, that is self-sufficient, security-focused national economies rather than this, globalism. And of course, that goes against the Fukuyama thesis of end of history, where we'd all live in a free trade world and nation state would be at an end. We're heading back to the nation state somehow. Is that sort of your conclusion in your book? We've got a minute left.
Yeah, exactly right. Both Friedman and Fukuyama were wrong. And in fact, we see this in all the European elections. I'm sure you follow this, whether it's Hungary, Slovakia, most recently Portugal, Argentina, Italy, everywhere you're starting to see these populist revolts saying, no, we want to take our country back and have a country. And I think in the fall here in America, you're going to see that populist revolt writ large with the re-election of President Trump.
Mm. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Larry. I'd love to have you on again, and a brilliant exposition there of big topics. And you can follow Larry Schweikart. You can read his books on the internet. Just Google around. And We are going to call it a day for this Tuesday afternoon on the last day of April, wall purges night in Sweden. The whole country is going to go to party and throw witches into bonfires. And we will bring you back to with the day's news tomorrow at same time, 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock. This is the Pelle Nerov Taylor Show on TNT. We look forward to having you back tomorrow. Thank you very much.